Richard Martin's Wake Up Call Podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Greetings to you all, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Wake Up Call on this Friday, January the 22nd, 2016. This is Richard Martin talking to you from a very monsoon-ridden Malaysia, albeit in glorious sunny and warm weather, which lasts all year round. This will be my final attempt to persuade you of the advantages of donating to the show. I have barely 5% of the readership who have been gracious enough to contribute to this endeavour. It may not be clear to you just how much effort goes into creating these shows for you. It's not rocket science. I spend a week perusing all manner of internet information to cull the ideas that I think will be of interest. This is an open-ended task. I never know how long it will take me to create what I hope will be an interesting show for you. I try to provide a mix of information, commentary, and off-topic ideas to catch you off your guard, and I must admit I love to build each show and watch it come together over the days leading up to publication. Amazingly, it always does. There are very few shows where I am at a loss to bring material before you, and it usually coincides with some major news item, like Hillary Clinton again being found in contravention of some rule or regulation pertaining to the maintenance of state secrets. The only downside to my work at the Wake Up Call is that it is a full-time job. I literally do not have time for anything else other than looking after my investors' portfolios. In many ways, I feel I've done my job here. I've prepared you all for what is to come. You know the story. You know what to look for. We have rehearsed this ad infinitum. This would be a perfect point for me to withdraw, comfortable in the knowledge that I had done my part. I have, in fact, discussed this with people in recent weeks. I have been overwhelmed by the uniform reaction. No, please don't go away. We need you to guide us through the nightmarish twists and turns over the next few years. At first, I thought it was mere flattery, but I realized that these people were serious. Apparently, there is a tremendous whirl of support for my bi-weekly talks. That's when I realized that we've reached a turning point here. If I do decide to close this down, I will be happy to think that the last few years have borne fruit. And for those who were paying attention, it has not been in vain. But frankly, the show has become a kind of an addiction for me. I see what goes on a weekly basis, and I'm drawn to wanting to share it with you. But, my friends, my faithful listeners, I really am going to need more support. This should not be such a stretch. Many of you have been listening since the show began over 10 years ago. I'm sorry if I have led you to believe that listening to the show was easy street. It obviously has been for a very long time, but things are going to have to change. So please, ladies and gentlemen, one final time. Think hard about what you will miss if this show goes away. Because once it's gone, it's gone. There will be no bringing it back. I will have moved on to other challenges. Do you want the show? Do you care? I know you do. I only have to look at the viewing numbers. So please, make an effort. It has to be worth something to you. And as always, my heartfelt thanks go out to those of you who have contributed. Despite all that I have said today, I am overwhelmingly grateful to those of you who have free-willingly donated. One final thing, for those of you who really do not have the means to donate, if you will send me an email explaining your situation, if I have to curtail the show and send it just to those who have donated, I will include you too. All current donors, as I've said before, will be covered right up to the end of the subscription period. I'll let you know my decision late next week. Thank you all. You have my email plastered all over the show page at Podbean. My phone number is area code 305 in the States, 454-2707. Once again, 305-454-2707. Well, we've only really been in 2 weeks of trading in the new year, and things are looking pretty bad, to say the least. So predictably, the press are asking and often answering questions about when the slump will be over. Rebound, recovery, the usual terminology. When will we get back to growth? For me personally, but that's just me, that last question sounds a bit more stupid every single time I hear or read it. Luckily, the answer is easy. The slump will not be over for a very, very long time. There will be no rebound or recovery. And please ask these idiots to stop talking about a return to growth, unless they can explain what it is they want to grow into. I'm sorry, I know that's not what they're going to want to hear, but life's a bitch, and so is the economy. We've lived on pink fumes for a long time, actually, for most of us, our whole lives. But reality dictates that real growth stopped decades ago, and almost nobody ever figured that out, because we and the world we're part of became addicted to borrowing money, spending it, and passing this off as growth. The fact that people believed this was actual growth, however, is on them. The patsies fell for a scam, and now we're all going to have to pay the price. If there's one single thing people are good at, it's lying. It's as old as human history, and it happens every day, so you're no exception to any rule. You're perhaps just not particularly clever. How do we know a recovery is so far off? It's really no use even to talk about it. As I said, it's easy. I've sent out any number of charts through my email service that describes the situation elegantly. Many of them originate with the St. Louis Fed. The statistics are somewhat, sometimes suspect, and you really do sometimes have to wonder about the parameters the St. Louis Fed uses for its long-term data and graphs, and whether growth was all that solid in the run-up to 2008. There's plenty of very valid arguments that would say growth in the 1960s was a whole lot more solid than that in the 2000s after the Glass-Steagall repeal and after the dot-com blubber. However, that's not what I want to take away from this. I like to show what has happened since 2008, more than before, when it comes to passing debt off as growth. But there's another thing that's happened since 2008, or rather not happened, that points out to us why this slump will have legs. That is, in 2008, a behemoth bubble started bursting, and it was by no means just the US housing market. That bubble should have been allowed to deflate fully, because that's the only way to allow an economy to perform a viable restart. Instead, all that's been done since 2008, quantitative easing, zero interest rate policy, the works, has been aimed at keeping a facade alive and aimed at protecting the interests of the bankers and other rich parties. That facade was expressed most of all in rising stock markets, and it's allowed for societies to be gutted while people were busy watching the S&P rise to 2,100 and the Kardashians bear as many body parts. It was all paid for, apart from Western quantitative easing, with $28 trillion and change of newfangled Chinese debt. The problem with this is that if you find yourself in a bubble and you don't go through the inevitable deleveraging process that follows said bubble in a proper fashion, you're not only going to kill economies, you'll destroy entire societies. And that's not just morally repugnant. It also works as much against the rich as it does against the poor. Unfortunately, that's a step too far for most people to understand. The fact is that even the rich need a functioning society, and that inequality, as we see it today, is a real threat to everyone. Recognizing this simple fact and the consequences that follow from it is nothing new. It's why, in days of old, there were debt jubilees. It's also why we still quote the following from Mariner Eccles, chairman of the Federal Reserve under FDR and Truman, from 1934 to 1948, in his testimony to the Senate Committee on the Investigation of Economic Problems in 1933, which prompted FDR to make him chairman in the first place. And I quote, "It is utterly impossible, as this country has demonstrated again and again, for the rich to save as much as they have been trying to save, and save anything that is worth saving. They can save idle factories and useless railroad coaches. They can save empty office buildings and closed banks. They can save paper evidence of foreign loans. But as a class, they cannot save anything that is worth saving above and beyond the amount that is made profitable by the increase of consumer buying. It is for the interests of the well-to-do to protect them from the results of their own folly, that we should take from them a sufficient amount of their surplus to enable consumers to consume and business to operate at a profit. This is not soaking the rich, it is saving the rich. Incidentally, it is the only way to assure them the serenity and security which they do not have at the present moment." End of quote. You know, everything would all be so much simpler if only more people understood this, that you need a fleeting, ever-changing equilibrium to prosper. Instead, we're falling into that same trap again. Or, more precisely, we've already done so. We've been fighting debt with more debt and building the facade put up by the Fed, the Bank of Japan, and the European Central Bank. These are central banks that all face the same problems and all take the same approach. Save the rich at the cost of the poor. Something Eccles said way back when, even then, it couldn't possibly work. There's been no deleveraging, the number one requirement after a bubble bursts. There's only been even more deleveraging. More debt has been issued. And while households have perhaps deleveraged a token amount, though, that is likely strongly influenced by losses on homes, etc., plus the fact that people were simply maxed out. There has been no material conscious effort to deleverage from debt anywhere in the system. It's perhaps striking to note that big growth spurts happened in the days when Reagan, Clinton, and Obama were the respective US presidents. Not so much in the Bush era. China is what allowed the post-2008 global economic facade to have fake credibility, an insane rise in debt, largely spent on non-productive overinvestment, overcapacity highways to nowhere, and many millions of empty apartments, in what could have been a cool story had Beijing not gone all out on performance-enhancing financial narcotics. Today, the China Ponzi is on its last legs, and so is the global one, because China was the last not yet conquered market large enough to provide the facade with fleeting credibility. Unless Elon Musk gets us to Mars very soon, there will be no more such markets. So US debt will have to come down too, belatedly, with China. And it will have to do so now, because there are no continents to conquer and hide the debt behind. We're all going to regret engaging in the debt game and not letting the bubble deflate in an orderly fashion when we still could have. But all those thoughts are too late now. What the facade has wrought is not just the idea that deleveraging was not needed, though it always is after every single bubble, but that net US household worth rose by 55% in the 6 to 7 years since the bottom of the crisis, an artificial bottom fabricated with, yes, more debt, with quantitative easing and zero interest rate policy. Meanwhile, in today's world, as stock markets go down at a rapid clip, China has lost control of a market system it never really had the control over, and now it's playing a game of Ponzi whack-a-mole with erratic policies such as circuit breakers and CIA-style renditions of fund managers and the like. And all the West can do is watch them fumble the ball, and another one, and another. And this whole thing is just starting out. China's bad loans have now become a theme in their own right. But the theme is meaningless without including the shadow banking system, which in China has been given the opportunity to grow like a tumor and on which Beijing's grip is limited. It has huge claims on local party officials forced by the Politburo to show overblown growth numbers. That's where the bad loans are to be found. Chinese credit or debt graphs paint only a part of the picture without including shadow banks, but keeping their role hidden is one of Xi's main goals, lest the people find out how bad things really are and start revolting. But they will anyway. That makes China a very unpredictable entity. And unpredictable means volatile. And that means even more money flowing out of markets and being lost in them. The least worst place to be for what money will be left is United States dollars placed in United States treasuries. But there'll be a whole lot less left than just about anyone thinks. That's the price of deleveraging. The price of not deleveraging, on the other hand, is what we see in the markets today. And there is no cure. It must be done. The price for keeping up the facade rises sharply with each passing day, and the effort in the end will be futile. All bubbles have limited lifespans. Let me close this with a few recent words from Tim Morgan, who puts it so well, I don't feel the need to try and do it better. Quote, "In order to set the Ponzi economy into some context, let's put some figures on it. In the United States, total real economy debt, which excludes interbank borrowing, increased by $19.4 trillion in real inflation-adjusted terms between 2000 and 2014, whilst real GDP expanded by only $3.7 trillion. Britain, meanwhile, added £1.9 trillion of new debt for less than £400 billion on growth over the same period. I spent part of the holiday period unearthing quite how much debt countries added for each dollar of growth over a period starting at the end of 2000 and ending in mid-2015. Unsurprisingly, when talking about dollars of debt spent for every dollar of growth generated, the league is topped by Portugal. $5.65 of debt for each dollar of growth. Ireland, $5.42. And Greece, $5.39. Britain's ratio at $3.46 is somewhat flattering in that the UK has used asset sales as well as borrowing to sustain its consumption. The average for the Eurozone, at $3.54, covers ratios as diverse as Germany, just $1.87, and France, $4.22. China's $2.56 looks unexceptional until you note that the more recent post-2007 number is much worse. Economies which seem to have been growing without too much borrowing, such as Brazil and Russia, are now experiencing dramatic worsening in their ratios, generally in the wake of tumbling commodity prices. In the proverbial nutshell, then, the world has become addicted to borrowing money, spending it, and passing this off as growth. This is a copybook example of a pyramid scheme, which in turn means that the world's most influential economic mentor is neither Keynes nor Hayek, but Charles Ponzi. How, in the absence of growth, can inflated capital values be sustained? The answer, of course, is that they can't. Like all Ponzi schemes, this ends with a bang, not with a whimper. This is why I find forecasts of a big fall or sharp correction in markets hard to swallow. Ponzi schemes don't end gradually, any more than someone can fall off a cliff gradually or be slightly pregnant. The Ponzi economy simply continues for as long as irrationality prevails and then implodes. Capital markets, though, are the symptom, not the cause. The fundamental problem is an inability to detach from an addictive practice of manufacturing supposed growth on the basis of borrowed money. End of quote. So there may be shallow lulls in the asset markets. Nothing ever only falls down in a straight line in the real world, but that debt I've described here must and will come down and be deleveraged. The process will inexorably lead to warfare and to refugee movements, the likes of which the world has never seen in terms of sheer numbers of people added to the world population over the past 50 years. When your children reach your age, they will not live in a world that you ever thought was possible, but they will still have to live in it and deal with it. They will no longer have the facade you've been staring at for so long now to lull them into a complacent sleep. And the Kardashians will no longer be looking so attractive either. So, if you believe the official propaganda, no other nation in the history of the world has advanced the cause of humanity more than North Korea. According to the North Korean Ministry of Truth, their great nation has cured cancer, Ebola, AIDS, SARS, MERS, and much, much more. Now they're saving the world again, this time having invented an extra-strength adult beverage that won't leave you feeling like a train wreck the next morning. It's hangover-free alcohol. Perhaps next they'll invent calorie-free chocolate. Clearly, this is an idiotic fantasy. Alcohol has chemical properties which have a severe physiological impact on the human body when consumed in excess. If you drink too much alcohol, there are consequences, both short-term and long-term. Simple. Yet the North Korean government is deceiving an entire nation of devout followers that they have invented a cure-all panacea. Drink as much as you want and don't worry about the consequences. Now, we can all poke endless fun at the North Koreans' gullibility. But frankly, I don't find the idea of hangover-free alcohol any dumber or less deceptive than the idea of consequence-free debt, or the idea that you can print your way to prosperity. North Koreans may be delusional enough to believe their government, but so are most Westerners. People in the so-called advanced world believe crazy fantasies all the time. We're told that the national debt doesn't matter, nor does it make the nation poorer, because, quote-unquote, we owe it to ourselves. And that pearl of wisdom, believe it or not, dear listeners, came from none other than your very own lovable Nobel Prize winner, Paul Krugman, whose immortal words were uttered on the 9th of February, 2015. It's as if the federal government, being unable to pay the debts it owes to Social Security recipients or to bank depositors in the US, is somehow less bad than stiffing China. We're told the State of Our Union is strong. And that was your indomitable Prezi, the Honorable Barack Obama, spouting off his own laughable brand of inanities last week. Yet trust in government is near an all-time low. Wealth inequality is extreme. The middle class is no longer the clear majority in America. And the national debt is at an all-time high of nearly $19 trillion. We're told that Medicare and Social Security are not in crisis. Barry again, the 13th of July, 2015. Yet the annual report from the Treasury Secretary of the United States tells us that one of the program's major trust funds is completely out of cash and the rest are running out. We're told that running huge budget deficits don't matter because the government can print more money. Yes, siree, that's the Krug person again on the 31st of January, 2013. Because apparently there are absolutely zero consequences when the Federal Reserve conjures money out of thin air. Except, you see, that there are consequences. Every dollar the Fed prints weakens its balance sheet and pushes it into insolvency. In fact, the Fed's own weekly financial report shows that its level of capital is a pitifully small 0.8% of its total assets. In other words, the Fed has almost zero margin of safety. And on a mark-to-market basis, the Fed is already insolvent. Yet the Federal Reserve claimed in a November 2014 white paper that its own insolvency, quote-unquote, would not create serious problems. As if decades of wild partying with their printing presses would be consequence-free. Western newspapers are certainly having a chuckle today at North Korea, with headlines making fun of the hangover-free alcohol hoax. But just imagine the fun they'd have if Kim Jong-un announced to the world that he had invented consequence-free debt or a perpetual money-printing machine. Western media would be having a field day with such propaganda. Arrogant and clueless that this is already our own reality. Hangover-free alcohol is pretty silly. But in the West, we believe the biggest lies of all. That you don't actually have to do anything. That your nation can simply print and borrow its way to prosperity until the end of time. All lies eventually collapse and reality settles in. Given the panic in global financial markets just in the first few weeks of 2016, that reality may be quickly approaching.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
Wow, the Dow is falling like a stone, much to the amazement of Jim Cramer. I guess you'll call this a buying opportunity. 10 years of banks calling liabilities assets is coming home to roost. The bank's mathematical accounting has run its course. Millions of failed home loans held by banks, and banks being allowed to call them assets, is over. After all, a turd by any other name is still a turd. And that piece of wisdom, ladies and gentlemen, comes to you directly from the pen of our very own Steve Kruger, who says, P.S. I bought gas today, $1.59 a gallon, and I was the only one there. Thank you, Steve. Words of wisdom, as always. According to William White, the Swiss-based chairman of the OECD's review committee and former chief economist of the Bank for International Settlements, the global financial system has become dangerously unstable and faces an avalanche of bankruptcies that will test social and political stability. Quote, the situation is worse than it was in 2007. Our macroeconomic ammunition to fight downturns is essentially all used up. Debts have continued to build up over the last 8 years, and they have reached such levels in every part of the world that they have become a potent cause for mischief. It will become obvious in the next recession that many of these debts will never be serviced or repaid, and this will be uncomfortable for a lot of people who think they own assets that are worth something. The only question is whether we are able to look reality in the eye and face what is coming in an orderly fashion, or whether it will be disorderly. Debt jubilees have been going on for 5,000 years, as far back as the Sumerians. End of quote. I remind you, ladies and gentlemen, that is the chairman of the OECD's review committee and the former chief economist for the Bank for International Settlements. This is commentary from the highest possible placed source. If ever I've said the expression word to the wise, it means more than ever what it says. So I've had lots of people comment on my appraisal of Obama's State of the Union speech. He's right, isn't he? Unemployment is down, as long as you don't count people not working. The economy is improving, as long as you only look at the top 10% and mostly the top 0.1%. America's the greatest country in the world, as long as you don't count third world infant mortality rates, growing food stamp rolls, growing poverty rates, childhood hunger, increasing debts, bankrupt cities and states, 70 million baby boomers retiring with almost no savings, 50 to 70 trillion unfunded healthcare and retirement costs, then sure, keep believing the joke that calls it the press. Oh, and do be sure to watch the morning news, which covers contests, recipes, celebrities, and similar embarrassing subjects for anyone calling themselves a newsman. Never listen to any naysayers or someone not sanctioned by Pravda to provide opinions or data or facts. And remember, Dorothy, there's no place like home. Okay, so here's a quick word about gold. I've said here on the show over and over again to be careful about gold. Gold can fall in price and yet be worth more in terms of other commodities, making its value rise, yes, even while the actual price is falling. Well, now we have this. Right now, an ounce of gold will purchase more oil than ever before. Now, if someone said that to you out of the blue, without you having any idea about the price of gold, or oil for that matter, I'll bet most of you would think that meant the price of gold was soaring to new record highs. If you were then to be told, well, no, actually, gold is trading near multi-year lows, you would be incredulous. You wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't understand how that was possible. Unless, of course, you'd been listening to the wake-up call. And that's the mistake everybody makes when they think that gold has to go higher in price. Notice they never give any proper reasoning for their gold bias. Just gold to $5,000 an ounce, or gold to infinity. They just cannot or don't want to conceive of the idea that the value of gold can rise even with a falling price. Get used to it. That's what happens in deflation. So month after month, I watch as the MSM mouthpieces try to spin declining consumers' spending in a positive light. They're practically out of excuses. They're befuddled because month after month they report awesome job gains and can't understand why all these gainfully employed Americans aren't buying stuff they don't need like they used to. These pretend journalists are just spouting propaganda for their ruling class bosses. They're willfully ignorant of the fact that the job gains are in low-paying part-time jobs, as well as the fact that Obamacare and record high rents are sapping all the discretionary income households would use to buy stuff. Despite the recent propaganda from the media and happy talk from the liar in chief, the country's currently in a recession, and the Fed has no ammo to fake another recovery. We are going down, and going down hard. When 70% of your economy is based on Americans buying crap they don't need from China on credit cards, a dramatic slowdown in consumer spending equals recession. When sales actually fall from November to December during the holiday season, you're in recession. We've arrived. The December report was a disaster and portends horrible retailer results coming down the road. More ghost malls are coming to your neighborhood. The annual results were pitiful, with the more recent months even more dreadful. So after adding 10 million jobs, according to Obama, spending declines? They must be great jobs. I think the results are even worse than portrayed in the results presented by the Census Bureau. Retail sales grew by only 2.2% in 2015 versus 2014. That is significantly less than the real inflation being experienced by real people. So on an inflation-adjusted basis, they fell. Even the 2.2% increase is artificially pumped up by the Fed-induced auto debt-fueled boom in car sales, or long-term rentals in reality. The zero-year, 0% auto loans, subprime auto loans to deadbeats, and record levels of auto leases have created fake demand that will end in tears when the defaults skyrocket. If you remove these fake sales, then total retail sales are up a pitiful 0.9% over 2014. When you realize that two of the few strong sales categories were autos at 7.5% and furniture stores at 5.8%, you can put your thinking cap on and realize the 7-year 0% financing scam is solely responsible for these sales. Reducing credit score criteria and extending loan terms always works, right? The other relatively strong area was internet sales at 6.3%. Amazon and the rest of the online retail segment continues to destroy the bricks and mortar retailers, but even these sales are slowing. They were up a weak 0.3% from November. Before the states started taxing internet sales, and it was still a newer concept, the annual growth rates were 15 to 20%. So the 6.3% growth rate is rather unimpressive, wouldn't you say? And this leads me to the strongest spending segment, restaurants and bars. Sales were up 8.1% over 2014 and continued strong in December. Business was booming in December and continues to be good in January. I think this strong spending simply shows that people are so miserable about the economy in general and the direction of the country, they have decided to drink and eat, for tomorrow we die. Dining out or getting loaded at a bar takes your mind off your troubles for a few hours. It's not a huge expenditure, and you just put it on your credit card and worry about it later. When the mass layoffs start hitting in 2016, even this category of spending will contract. If you think the 2015 consumer spending numbers were atrocious, you haven't seen anything yet. So, the global economy is in for a bumper ride in 2016, the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, has said. It slashed its growth forecast for the global economy for the third time in less than a year. According to the IMF, the world economy is set to grow by 3.4% this year and 3.6% in 2017. Both these estimates are 0.2 percentage points lower than its previous estimates made last October. The forecast comes hours after China reported its weakest annual growth in 25 years. They said, and I quote, "At the start of 2016, turbulence in financial markets has returned amid renewed concern about risks to global economic growth. The fundamental forces underlying our October World Economic Outlook projections have not dissipated and in some respects have intensified, leading us to trim our expectations for future medium growth of the world economy." End of quote. It is, of course, my belief that the economy and the markets are going to descend to depths infinitely lower than those of 2008, and this will be a long-term condition that we should all be preparing for. Let me talk in a little more detail about why I think this is the case. As you are sure to know by now, the S&P 500 began 2016 with its worst performance ever. This prompted Wall Street apologists to come out in full force and try to explain why the chaos in global currencies and equities will not be a repeat of 2008. They're anxious to prevent investors from believing that this environment is commensurate with the dot-com bubble bursting. They claim the current turmoil in China isn't even comparable to the 1997 Asian debt crisis. Indeed, the unscrupulous individuals that dominate financial institutions and governments seldom predict even as much as a downtick on Wall Street. So don't expect them to warn of the impending global recession and market mayhem. But a recession has occurred in the US about every 5 years on average since the end of World War II. And it's been 7 years since the last one, which means we're overdue. The average market drop during the peak to trough of the last six recessions has been 37%. That would take the S&P 500 down to 1,300 if the coming recession were to be just of the average variety. But this one's going to be worse. A major contributor for this imminent recession is the fallout from a faltering Chinese economy. The megalomaniac communist government has increased debt 28 times since the year 2000. This has taken that total over 300% of GDP in a very short period of time. The primary purpose of this was to build a massive, unproductive fixed assets bubble that added little to GDP. Now that this debt bubble is unwinding, growth in China is going offline. Three things clearly illustrate that China is not only growing at the promulgated 7%, but in fact isn't growing at all. They are the renminbi's falling value, cascading Shanghai equity prices, down 40% since June 2014, and plummeting rail freight volumes, down 10.5% year over year. The problem is that China accounted for 34% of global growth, and its multiplier effect on emerging markets that takes that number to over 50%. Therefore, expect more stress on multinational corporate earnings as global growth continues to slow. But the debt debacle in China is not the primary catalyst for the next recession in the United States. It is the fact that equity prices and real estate values can no longer be supported by incomes and GDP. And now that the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing and zero interest rate policy have ended, these asset prices are succumbing to the gravitational forces of deflation. The median home price to income ratio is currently 4.1, whereas the average ratio is just 2.6. Therefore, despite record low mortgage rates, first-time homebuyers can no longer afford to make the down payment. And without first-time homebuyers, existing homeowners can't move up. Likewise, the total value of stocks has now become dangerously detached from the anemic state of the underlying economy. The long-term average of the market cap to GDP ratio is around 75, but it is currently 110. The rebound in GDP coming out of the Great Recession was artificially engendered by the Fed's wealth effect. Now the re-engineered bubble in stocks and real estate is reversing and should cause a severe contraction in consumer spending. Nevertheless, the panacea offered by Wall Street is that another 2008-style deflation and depression is impossible because banks are now better capitalized. However, banks may find they are less capitalized than regulators now believe, because much of their assets are in treasury debt and consumer loans that should be significantly underwater after the next recession brings unprecedented fiscal strain to both the public and private sectors. But most importantly, even if financial institutions are less leveraged, the startling truth is that businesses, the federal government, and the Federal Reserve have taken on a humongous amount of additional debt since 2007. Even household debt has increased back to its 2007 record of $14.1 trillion. Specifically, business debt during that time frame has grown from $10.1 trillion to $12.6 trillion. The total national debt boomed from $9.2 trillion to $18.9 trillion, and the Fed's balance sheet has exploded from $880 billion to $4.5 trillion, ladies and gentlemen. Banks may be better off today than they were leading up to the Great Recession, but the government and the Fed's balance sheets have become insolvent in the wake of their inane effort to borrow and print the economy back to health. As a result, the federal government's debt has now soared to nearly 600% of total revenue. And the Fed has spent the last 8 years leveraging its balance sheet 77:1 in its goals going to pay short-term interest rates 0.07%. Therefore, this is an brutal upcoming recession will coincide with two unprecedented and extremely dangerous conditions that will, without question, make the next downturn much worse than that of 2008. First of all, the Fed will not be able to lower interest rates and provide any debt service relief for the economy. In the wake of the Great Recession, former Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke took the overnight interbank lending rate down to 0% from 5.25% and printed $3.7 trillion. The Fed bought longer-term debt in order to push mortgages and nearly every other form of debt to record lows. The only thing the Fed can do now is to take away its 0.25% rate hike made in December. And that's it. Secondly, the federal government increased the amount of publicly traded debt by $8.5 trillion, an increase of 170%, and ran $1.5 trillion deficits to try to boost consumption through transfer payments. Such rampings up in deficits and debt are a normal function of recessions after revenue collapses, but another one at this stage would cause an interest rate spike that would exacerbate this next recession into what is already a devastating depression. I really do think that even if, in order to avoid the surging cost of debt service payments on both the public and private sector level, the Fed feels compelled to launch a massive and unlimited round of bond purchases, with interest rates already at historic loss, faith in the ability of central banks to provide sustainable GDP growth has already been destroyed, given their failed 8-year experiment in quantitative easing, and therefore the ability of government to save the markets and the economy this time round will be impossible. Look for chaos in currency, bond, and equity markets on an international scale throughout 2016. Indeed, it has already begun. All right, so listen to the crap from the mainstream. January the 15th by Bloomberg, Matthew Boessler. The U.S. economy should continue to grow faster than its potential this year, supporting further interest rate increases by the Federal Reserve. New York Fed President William C. Dudley said, "In terms of the economic outlook, the situation does not appear to have changed much." Since the Fed's December the 15th, 16th meeting, Dudley said in remarks prepared for a speech Friday. He added that he continues to expect that the economy will expand at a pace slightly above its long-term trend in 2016, and said future rate increases would depend on incoming economic data. End of quote. Then, January the 15th, Reuters by Anne Saphir. "The stock market's swoon does not change the economic outlook and is merely market participants trying to make sense of global developments," San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank President John Williams told reporters. "As the Fed is moving gradually through a process of normalization, it's not surprising that we're not going to be at peak stock prices of last year. So far, swings in stock prices have not fundamentally changed my expectation for moderate economic growth." End of quote. So the Fed is apparently perfectly satisfied with watching the entire planet's casinos burn to the ground. Well, corporate defaults are the highest since 2009, and Standard & Poor's said a couple of weeks ago that the outlook for corporate borrowers worldwide was the worst since the global financial crisis. This isn't necessarily such a bad thing, because obviously if times are bad, corporations probably don't need or want to borrow to finance activities so much. The importance of this information is much more as a message indicating unmistakably and with no risk of statistical manipulation just how bad things are. Corporations know this too. Their concern is having too much liquid cash, not wanting to invest it in their business because of perceived hard times ahead, and not knowing what to do with it in the meantime. For our purposes, you should use this information as a strong signal that very bad times lie ahead for us all. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, finished for today. I've said my little homily about donating. I assure you, you are going to need to do this, those of you who are in a position to do so, and it's not going to be consequence-free, as we said, if you do not. So please be kind enough to think hard about it. Pull out that credit card and throw in some dough. All right. So this is Richard Martin from the Wake Up Call, wishing you a great, great, great weekend ahead. I will be back on Monday, as always. Until then, bye-bye.
And there you have it. You decide.